It's time now for the Sports Objective Podcast. No talking heads, just guys who love sports. Here's Dave Richmond.
Welcome into a very special edition of the Sports Objective Podcast. I am Dave Richmond, along with my great co-host, with first Kyle from LaGrange Barber. What's up, dude?
Cool on, David. How are you?
Great evening, and hope you're doing well. And also want to bring in Bubba Rosenbaum. What's up, Bubba?
Not much. Doing well. Good to be with you guys.
Yes, sir. We got some, obviously, we'll talk some breaking news to you. Plus, guys, we got three big interviews that we wanted to get out to folks. And we wanted to do that tonight, a special edition of the Sports Objective Podcast. In fact, we'll have, let's see, Mike Maniscalco of the Carolina Hurricanes. They're off to a great start, the best in since they moved to Raleigh. We also have legendary coach in Bill Curry. And last but not least, we also have Jim McMahon of the, how about the Super Bowl Shuffle and the Chicago Bears, and also the backup quarterback for the Green Bay Packers when they won a Super Bowl. So a two-time Super Bowl champion and Jim McMahon. So we got a big show. And obviously, guys, we wanted to talk to about, we've got some breaking news today that we heard Holton Ahlers, no surprise, that he's actually going to be the starting QB. And Kyle, I'm going to start with you because I know that you and Bubba and I agreed on that. How do you feel about Holton starting on Saturday night against the number 9? We want to mention that too, UCF Knights.
Well, it's a hell of a way to get your first start as a true freshman. You know, Holton's obviously played in some games, but to be the starting quarterback and it be against the number 9 rank, haven't lost a game and going on 2 years, UCF Knights, that's a heck of a way to baptize them under fire, so to speak. At this point, man, I mean, unless I see something Saturday night that shocks me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who starts. We've been here through this now since 2016. We've started six different quarterbacks. We've had six different quarterbacks play.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You have Brett Favre. It doesn't matter.
What do you think, Bubba?
Yeah, Scotty's announcement today at the weekly press conference, and it didn't surprise me, especially after his post-game press conference remarks after the game the other night against Houston. But, no, like Kyle said, what, against Temple we had less than 200 yards of offense. And, yeah, I know we finished with over 400 the other night, I think 425 or something like that. I mean, anybody that watched that ball game, they know that early in the fourth quarter, maybe even 9-10 minutes left in the ball game, we had like 225, 230 yards of offense. So another very poor night from the offense. So I'm okay with it. But like Scotty said today, and this is just pretty much anybody that knows anything about football and knows what we're about to venture into, starting a true freshman quarterback, and this is no knock on Holton by any means, but it's just the reality of things. Expect the growing pains. Don't expect Holton Ahlers to be perfect because it's not going to happen. Do I think he's going to make a lot of big plays like he's already done in the running game? Absolutely. But and I think he'll continue to develop as a passer, like we saw in the action he had the other night against the Houston Reserves. But there are going to be those growing pains. There were times where he got away with a thing or two, throwing off his back foot late into the middle of the field. So hopefully he'll continue to learn, grow up, and develop into the quarterback that we all know he can be.
Yeah, I'm with you, Bubba. I think it, you know, goes without saying. Look, it ain't like Reed has exactly been lighting it up, and that's I'm not gonna Reed. You're talking about growing pains. Look, while Reed had been here, knowing the offense longer, you know, he hadn't played in any games either until this year. So, if anybody thinks Ahlers is going to come in here and we're just that's going to turn things around, and now you're going to see us just roll. You're going to be very disappointed Saturday night. I mean, I don't think it matters. I hope for Holton's sake he doesn't get injured or anything like that. And my biggest concern is I hope his confidence isn't hurt, playing for Montgomery and Peterson this year. And when we get a real offensive coach and a real head coach and a real offensive coordinator in here next year, that they haven't screwed Holton up. That's my biggest fear.
You read my mind, and we talked about that on the playback, is the very fact that Holton actually is a tremendous quarterback. I think he's got – I know, Bubba, you play the position, but he's got a tremendous upside. The thing that bothers me is not Holton. The thing that bothers me is that when you have three talented quarterbacks with limited or no experience, you need to be patient. The problem is our program is not at a point where you can be patient, and that's why there's a conflicting things there. And I agree with you, Kyle. I worry about injury. I also worry about, you know, if Spellacy's out for the year. I found that out today. I didn't realize that. I missed that for center. And so he was, you know, he's a big deal. And then you align, we'll see how they can hold up. But it doesn't matter who you have behind, you know, behind the line there at quarterback. If you don't have a line, then everybody knows that you got to have a line to run the game and to protect the quarterback. And is there any possible way you see the Pirates winning on coming up on Saturday night?
Yeah. If UCF comes down with mononucleosis,
you give us no chance of winning it?
The entire team. No, I don't know we ain't got a chance. No. No, I mean, anything's possible, but no. I mean, come on, no. I'd be shocked. I'd be pleasantly surprised and shocked. But no, I mean, anytime you put the football out there on the field, two teams line up, there's a chance, but a realistic chance, no.
Bubba, so between 0 to 100, do you think it's even a 10% chance?
0 to 100? I'd say 5%.
Okay. What about you, Bubba? What do you think?
Well, guys, when you take a look at it, obviously the line opened at, what, 24, 25?
Down to 21 now, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, depending on where you looked. And then, like you just mentioned, you stole my thunder a bit. That's what I was going to say. The money's going on the Pirates. And we're down to 21, guys. But I'm like Kyle. I mean, it would take the perfect storm for us to be able to pull off the upset. Something, I mean, you know, we've talked about the tremendous improvement that our defense has made. But with that said, and I'm gonna say we haven't done a good job of forcing turnovers. What, we've only forced 3 or 4 all year.
Surprising to me.
Yeah, and considering the amount of pressure we've gotten on the quarterback, 22 sacks. In six games, if that continues, you think we're going to get a strip or force some?
This will be the week, Bubba. Maybe this will be the week. So
maybe this is the week that we get 3 or 4 turnovers and then don't commit a single turnover ourselves. Which starting a true freshman quarterback is probably unlikely, but it's going to take something like that, being +3 or +4 in the turnover battle, and then playing much better red zone defense than we've had, because as much improvement as we've shown on that side of the ball, going into last week, we were one of 6 teams that had allowed points every time our opponent had been in the red zone.
Ooh, yeah,
I think it was us, North Carolina, maybe Tennessee, and 3 others. I don't recall who, but I don't know if Tennessee turned that stat around down at Auburn, but they did get a huge win, snapping an 11-game SEC losing streak.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize it had been. I guess that makes sense, but it didn't feel like it was that many. But
wow. More breaking news from the program, guys. I got busted tonight. The announced attendance for the game was just under 29,000, I believe. Actual ticket scanned, butts and seats, folks that were there, 18,000.
Wow.
Yep. Had not seen that.
I do
recall last year that Tulane game where it was so cold. But it was, what, like 12.5, 13,000 scanned tickets, supposedly.
Yeah, yeah. There was only 12,000.
Per Pirate Radio.
Yeah, I remember that very well. I was there that night, and, you know, of course, we tied the game up when it gets very cold. I was shivering.
Well, this past Saturday night, the weather was perfect. The weather didn't have nothing to do with this past Saturday. It was just people disgusted. It was people disgusted that had better things to do on Saturday night than to go watch that nonsense. I mean, it's really, people are getting tired of it. And you got the handful of people that seem to just support Mo that just can't admit they're wrong. They just can't admit they're wrong. But I got a feeling, and I hope I'm wrong. Believe me, I don't want anybody to. I hope we win three more games to get to a bowl. Or excuse me, we need to win four more games to get to a bowl.
Right.
I hope Holton comes out and lights it up, man. But I'm telling you, it's a lot of the people. There's going to be even more people. A lot of the Holton fans are gonna. If he doesn't perform well, they're really going to turn on Mo.
That's what I was getting at, is that all three of us on this podcast love Holton Ahlers. I love Morgan. I think he's awesome. And the problem, what we're talking about is, number one, for the sake of the program and the kid being Holton Ahlers, everybody's going to say, well, you say hindsight is 20/20, but more than likely he should have been redshirted. But that's here nor there. That's not going to happen, number one. Number two, we know that Mo was trying to save his job. Three, it was probably a promise recruiting that you're going to start as a true freshman, so that way he wouldn't go to Alabama, Florida, wherever. I mean, he had all these big name schools.
Yeah, Jeff Charles, actually, I was listening because, you know, I left the game in the third quarter, so I was listening all the way home. Jeff Charles actually mentioned, I don't know how this came to light recently, that when P.J. Fleck got the job at Minnesota, P.J. came and came to Greenville late, right before signing day.
That's correct.
Trying to get Holton to go to Minnesota and row the boat.
Yeah, well, my point to the whole thing about Holton is just simply that we all love Holton, so it may sound like we're not anti-Holton. What we want to see is, number one, like we said, for him, his safety, number one, to be safe when you start a kid. I worry about, like you said, Kyle, you and I both agree on that, and I think Bubba as well, on the confidence of Holton. You're starting a kid. Now, he's got the confidence. So, I mean, there's no question he's got confidence. There's no question.
You don't want him to get ruined.
Right. You don't want it to be where – that's why, and to me, I'm going to get back to you, but Bubba, I want to get your take on this too. When it comes to football, the reason why you have a red shirt year is because there's a huge
learning
leap
curve
from high school to college, and that's why you have a red shirt year, right? I mean, am I wrong on that?
No, I'm going to say, obviously, when you can, you want a red shirt, as many freshmen as you potentially can. But then now and then you have your Zay Jones and guys of that caliber who, at the skill positions, is, of course, where you typically see it. Receiver, maybe every now and then running back or DB, but typically O-line, D-line, it's not as likely to see somebody not red shirt, particularly on the O-line. And then occasionally you may have a guy of the caliber of Limble Joseph or somebody like that who just comes in and is just a man amongst boys, but very rarely in the trenches are you going to have a guy that's ready to play right away coming out of high school. And then what – last year you did see that with John Spellacy.
Yeah, to play devil's advocate with Holton with the true freshman thing, maybe he should have been starting all along. And the reason I say that is you do see more and more true freshmen starting at the quarterback position in college football these days. And it's not often that East Carolina has a kid that's offered by Florida, Georgia, Minnesota, Missouri, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, if Holton's good enough to get those kind of offers, then, you know, maybe he should have been starting as a freshman. And if you're going to burn his red shirt, at this point, his redshirt's burnt, so he play his ass.
Right. I agree with you.
His redshirt's burnt, so play him. Let's play devil's advocate. You know, my whole thing is, to me, if in terms of this season and what's going to happen, unless he just comes out there and it's just lights it up, and it's just, I just don't see how he at this point is going to save our season. Maybe had you started them from game one, maybe by now he'd be developed to that point where he could do it. But I mean, it's at this point, it's just, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I guess I do know what I'm trying to say. Unless we're going to get to the point where we're flirting with a bowl game, I mean, who gives a damn?
Well, not only that, but here's another thing that came to mind. And with you guys loving sports like I do, when I was in senior in high school in Williamston for the Tigers, when I played senior baseball, I played baseball my senior year, I'll never forget the coach, Mike Farrell, saying, if I can lose with seniors, I can lose with sophomores. So what I feel like is the problem that Scotty Moe's had all along is we didn't have the quarterbacks with quarterback experience, and so why not give Holton a year of experience? I mean, if it's going to be where we feel like he's definitely the future, and maybe Fifetti and Reed Herring are not going to work out, then why not? But we'll see how things play out, and you never know. I just feel like with the situation, I'm just praying for Holton to have a great game, and I'm excited about him coming on. And one of the things I want to see this week, Kyle, because your favorite position, we're going to the practice. We'll see if we can get some we'll see how things go there. But the running game, we've got to establish the running game, right?
Yeah. And let's not break the game down too much. This isn't the preview.
Yeah.
Let's save a lot of that 4-hour preview.
We will.
It's coming up Thursday, everyone. But, yeah, we do need to use the running game. Well, we will. With Holton in there, we'll be able to run the ball better.
Yeah.
That's inevitable. That I can guarantee you. With Holton in there, we'll be able to run the ball better. That I know is going to happen.
And we desperately need, if there's any hope of winning the football game and keeping it close to where we have a chance to win a game, we've got to be able to run the football and play very good defense.
Yes, those two things will have to happen. And like Bubba said, force some turnovers for us to have a chance against UCF.
Well, I wanted to go ahead, before we get too much into ECU, we'll get back to more of that, but I had a chance to sit down last week with a friend of mine from the Carolina Hurricanes. The guys, I'm telling you, they're off to a great start. Mike Maniscalco, who is the sideline reporter and covered the team for over a decade now. Let's go to him and talk some Carolina Hurricanes hockey, and we'll be right back. Well, it's been a big week for the Carolina Hurricanes, so I want to bring in my friend, a man that knows a ton about hockey, and that is my good friend Mike Maniscalco. Mike, thanks, man. Appreciate you coming on again.
No, Dave, really appreciate it, and thanks for the buildup. I think there are those who would argue my knowledge of hockey, but I appreciate it.
Well, over the last decade or so, you've been in the Raleigh area, and now with the Carolina Hurricanes, with the team itself, you've covered this team. I'm just so excited. In fact, I thought about a greatest hits album from Bryan Adams, So Far, So Good. That's my theme for this week for the team.
That's pretty good. Hopefully, if we'll go down the Bryan Adams road, can't stop this thing they've started. It's actually we've started, but I modified the title for you. And, you know, I think from training camp, there was this different feeling, Dave, around the team. I've said this before. It just felt a little bit lighter, a little bit looser in the good sense of the word. Rookies weren't afraid, or young players aren't afraid to make mistakes because it's not going to cost them playing time, or they're not going to be glued to the bench. And you're starting to see that with the start to the season that they had. You know, the preseason wasn't a fluke. And 99% of the time, Dave, if you would have brought me on and said, well, this team went, you know, undefeated in the preseason, or this team went like the Canes did, go, you know, 4-0-2. They didn't lose in regulation. You know, does that mean anything? My answer would be no. But for this team that's trying to build a culture, that's trying to lay down a foundation of how to win, I think that the preseason results were really important. because it's laid down this foundation that they've carried over as we're talking into the first four games of the season for the Canes, and that's why they're at a 3-0-1 mark right now.
Well, another reason for me is, speaking of themes, I've got an idea for a segment. I know you've talked about the ages on there, and I looked them up. The movie Young Guns, I've got those for Sebastian Aho, 21, Warren Fogle's 22, and Andrei Svechnikov is 18. I mean, you know, can you get any younger than that?
No, and it just makes me feel older. it's funny because the game has changed a lot where players of that age can come in and not just be part of the team, but be significant contributors of the team. But that's the way that hockey has changed over the last 10, 15 years, where we've seen it before, the impact of Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, Jack Eichel, Patrick Laine, those players who come into the league and have a big spot on their team right away. And, you know, the Canes, they didn't draft in the top two until they got Andrei Svechnikov. So that bar is set that you, if you're drafted at this level, you need to compete right away. Well, so far, Andrei Svechnikov, after, you know, a little bit of struggles in camp, and it's more defensively than offensively, but a little bit of struggles in the preseason with what we saw, just because it's an 18-year-old trying to play against 25, 26-year-olds who've been in the league for a couple of years. He's figured it out quickly. Rod Brind'Amour sang his praises, and you can't say enough about Sebastian Aho right now and Warren Fogle with their contributions to the team. And there's another one, the 19-year-old Martin Natchez, who I think he's waiting to have an offensive explosion for this team.
Well, definitely offense is very, very young, which is not a bad thing. You actually taught me we've lost Jeff Skinner and Cam Ward in the offseason, I know, and that's one thing you taught me early this year when we had you on, I think, the first time, is you can't really get attached to the players. It's really your allegiance should be to the team. And, again, so far so good. It's looking like that the changes have worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the early results, but I think we're really going to see, Dave, this team get tested with the road trip coming up. Minnesota, Winnipeg, back-to-back nights. Minnesota's a tough team in their own building. Winnipeg might be the best team in the West. I know that there's some teams that want to lay claim to that, but the way Winnipeg's built, they're outstanding. Then you got to fly down to Tampa Bay. So you're playing, you know, two really elite teams and a team in Minnesota that can give you everything that you want to try to handle in a hockey game. So it's going to be an interesting test. We'll see about a week from now where this team's at, but I think they're going to acquit themselves quite well.
We talked about this, I think, a third time you've been on, about the team hasn't made the playoffs since 2009. It's looking like, I know you said, I think you've said before, listening to you, previously, that it comes down to pretty much, what, 10 games, the difference between making the playoffs and not making the playoffs?
Yes, usually that's it. And as a matter of fact, Michael Smith and I just talked about it on the Canescast podcast that you can get at the Hurricane site, hurricanes.com, and there's other places where you can go download it and listen to it. But there's the old axiom, you can't win the Stanley Cup in October, but you can make it darn near impossible to get into the playoffs with a bad October. This is the best start that this organization has had, Dave. You got to go back to when they were up in New England playing in Connecticut as the Hartford Whalers, 95-96. It's the best start that they've gotten off to, getting points in its first four games. So let's see if they can keep that rolling.
Is there a benchmark? I know every year is different. Is there a benchmark you're looking for the total amount of points that you know that you've got a good shot to get into the playoffs?
Well, for me, I think it's if you get above 95 points, you should be in the playoffs. That's my low water mark for it. I think if this team can get to between 97 and 100, they'll be in the postseason without it. But 95 is usually, if you hit that mark, you're going to be in the playoffs. If not, it's been a real special year for a bunch of teams. So that's kind of the water level that I'll set. And, you know, it's still really early. We've got to see, you know, some teams still got to find their legs, and we'll see where they get to it. But that's usually the solid number for me. If you get to 95 or above, you're a playoff team.
And by the way, I'm a huge fan of Canescast. I listen to it all the time, and I want folks to listen to this podcast, to listen to Canescast. Definitely subscribe. And I know that you guys talk all the time about that you'll be the best. They'll be your best friends, right, if you give them five stars.
Yeah, five-star rating. Yeah, that's it. You can do the same thing, Dave. You can take that. Is not our gimmick alone.
Have,
you can have that.
Have.
So, you know, somebody gives you five stars, best friends, four stars, we're going to hang out, probably going to do lunch, three, we'll talk to you, two, you know, okay, at least you're listening, one, why, you're just being mean. So that's usually the rating system.
All right. There's been so many changes we talked about last time with, I mean, to say wholesale changes for this organization would be an understatement, right, for 2018?
True. They went to Costco, my friend, when it comes to wholesale. And I'm not talking about cheap. It's just the wholesale changes that they made. You take a look. It was a blue line that people thought was really good and couldn't get better. But they go out and add Calvin DeHaan and Dougie Hamilton. And Calvin DeHaan, all this guy does is block shots every, 14 seconds, it feels like, with his ability and what he's been able to do, and a good mix that he's brought to the team, good guy off the ice. Dougie Hamilton is just as smooth an offensive player on the blue line as you can see. And up front, there's a ton of changes. And the opening night roster featured 11 different players that were on the opening night roster from just a year ago. And that includes the addition of Curtis McElhaney, who they picked up on waivers after Scott Darling got injured. And I'll answer the question before it gets to it. Scott Darling, as of today, is still week to week with that lower body injury. But you pick up Curtis McElhaney, who's just a solid pro. He's a pro's pro. I hate using the term journeyman because I think that somehow has picked up a negative connotation. This guy's good enough to play in the NHL, and he's got two wins in his back pocket already for the Carolina Hurricanes. So they pick him up. They have Peter Mrazek in the Nets right now. And, from the young guys that they brought in or called up, this team has got a lot of things trending in the right direction in October. And generally, at this point, Dave, we're talking about where do the points come from now that they've let a few slip through their fingers. Well, now we're talking about a team that's got 7 out of its first possible 8 points. That's a pretty darn good start for anybody in the league.
Yes, and it's now the responsibility of winning, and you're talking about creating a culture. I'm a huge fan. We talked about that last time of the week before he got the job. Rod Brind'Amour, I think he was interviewing for the job at the time, and we were hoping that he would get it. He got the job, and you can just tell this is a Rod Brind'Amour team, that the way that they're playing. I think the word grit comes to mind, a great adjective. I don't want to meet Rod Brind'Amour, even at his age now, retired from the National Hockey League in a dark alley for sure. a real tough guy, and they're playing with a really true grit.
Well, Rod Brind'Amour is one of those guys. There's a question that gets asked on a show that I watch, an interview show, and it's, if you were in a foxhole, who would you want with you to help get you out? And Rod Brind'Amour, if he's not at the top of the list, he should be. He's just that guy who won't settle for less than your best effort. And, it doesn't mean that you're going to win or you're going to come out on the right side of the scoreboard, but if you play hard and you play consistent and play the right way, all the time, you're going to win more than you lose. And he's instilled this into this team already. He's instilled this work ethic of, you come to work every day to be better than what you were yesterday. And it's pretty intimidating, Dave, when you're in the weight room and your coach is putting up more on a bench press than you can. You've got to bring it. You got to show that you've got something else that you can bring to the party for him. And he just demands that you play the game the right way, that you play it with energy, you play it with enthusiasm. And I've been waiting for this. All these coaches sit in a room and try to figure out, how do we stop the other team from scoring? I've been waiting for a coach to say, okay, how do we score as much as humanly possible? And that seems to be in the early going. That's the mentality. Hockey's fun, and it's even more fun when you're scoring goals. So how can we score more goals as an organization? And that's what Rod Brind'Amour and assistant coach Jeff Daniels and on the blue line Dean Chenault, they're all working in concert right now. And I'm not saying they cracked the code, but they're pretty close to it, the way that this team has been in an offensive outburst the last two nights.
Definitely video game numbers. I have to ask you, I've been dying for the whole interview now, so I'm going to go ahead and ask you now. Tell me about what came about the celebratory jumping into the glass there. That is like phenomenal. I've had friends that I've shared that up on our Facebook page, and it definitely is. It's kind of like I equate it to the Lambo leap in Green Bay, even though it's not as famous as that.
Well, you keep winning and you can make something famous. So that's how we're looking at it. It came about, and Justin Williams, the captain, mentioned this. Every team at the end of the game now, end of a win, goes to center ice and, does the stick tap and the wave to the crowd. And it's great. It's a great acknowledgement, but it kind of feels, well, the Rangers did it, so now the Devils do it. Not that it's forced, but it's just like a lack of imagination. We're appreciative that you're here, but we're doing this because, it's all we can think of, and it's easy to do. Go to center ice after the game and do a twirl. this is something that it's fun. You know, it's fun for the players. It shows that they're having fun. It keeps the crowd around till the end of the game because they're going to have fun. And there's nothing wrong with it. And it's hard to win a hockey game. And I can attest to that. The difficulty it is to win a regular season game in the NHL. And when you get a win, go ahead and celebrate it. And I don't think that it's a slap in the face. I've read some, you know, and you can imagine where it's coming from. Well, it's not the way to celebrate. You know, hockey players should be more reserved. No, to hell with that. Go and have fun. You know, you play as hard as you can for 60 minutes. You get a big win. As long as you're not doing it in front of the other team while the other team's still on the ice or rubbing their face in it, have a celebration. Go ahead and have fun. You know, you hit a home run, flip a bat. As long as you're not throwing it at the pitcher or the catcher, go ahead and have fun. And that's what it is. And it was born out of a need to bring fun back to Raleigh with hockey and associate that this is a sport played with guys who love it. And it's a sport that if you watch it in person, it's the best sport to be at and see with your own eyes. It's I know I'm on the television side and I wish that I had a better answer than this, but sometimes, you know, TV does not do a hockey game justice the way it's sitting in the stands. It's opposed to the NFL for me, where I would rather watch an NFL game at home than go to an NFL game in person. And there's lots of reasons for it. Hockey's just better in person, and it's fun. And it was born out of this team wants to let the fans know that have stuck with them, they're going to have fun and come along for the ride because they're going to do a lot of things that aren't expected. So I think that's kind of where it was born out of.
And, Mike, I know that one of the things I've been very happy with Tom Dundon is the fact that, and this new regime, if you will, is the new owner, is the fact that there's a lot of great ticket values going on right now. I have a family of five. If I want to bring my whole family, it's a choice to go into Europe or most of the professional sports, including basketball and football, you have a choice to go into Europe or go into the game. And this particular case with the Hurricanes, it's always been a reasonable ticket compared to the rest of the teams in the Hockey Week, National Hockey Week. But this particular case, to be a professional sport, it's a really good value.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, that's one of the things that Tom Dundon noticed right away, that you got to get people in the building. And one of the ways to do that is you have to offer an appealing ticket price. And it's I'm not talking out of school here. You know, for a team that hasn't made the playoffs, and when Tom Dundon took over as the majority owner, it was 8 going on 9 seasons, you got to find a way to get people into the building, to get them to enjoy the product and take it in. And that's the one thing. And hockey is something where you can bring a family of four. Now, I'm not going to tell you that it's cheap, like you said, but it's also not – you don't have to scrap the 401K to come to a hockey game now here in Carolina. So hopefully the team keeps winning and the folks are looking at this and looking at the value that's being afforded to them with some of the ticket prices and special ticket offers that are out there. I know they got the Canes fam packs that are out there and the $40 tickets in the lower bowl right now, and part of those proceeds are going to help out Hurricane Florence relief. So lots of incentive to get folks here into the arena, and hopefully people will take the team up on that, because right now, as you've already hit the nail on the head, it's been a pretty fun product to watch, Dave, and we'll see if they can keep it up.
I can't wait to bring my son and daughter for their very first hockey game this season. And for sure, I want folks to go right now to CarolinaHurricanes.com, get your tickets, season tickets I know are there as well. Mike, how can they follow you on Twitter? And I hope they'll definitely listen to the podcast and give you a 5-star rating.
I hope they're listening to this podcast and giving you a 5-star rating, Dave. On Twitter, it's at Mike Maniscalco, and it's exactly like it sounds, Maniscalco. So that's it. But it's 4 games in, Dave. It's a lot of fun. I think that the hockey world is surprised at this, but if you were around this team in training camp, you know, I'm not sure if I expected them to not have a loss in regulation in the first 4, but I expected them to possibly have 6 points right now, and you know, they're one better than that. So let's see if they can keep it up. But there's lots of good stories right now, and you can point to other additions like Jordan Martinook and Michael Ferland, what they have brought. There's a different energy, a different vibe around this team, and I think that it's not going to go away. It's going to be here all season long.
I can't wait. It's going to be a great season, a great ride, and it's not how you start, it's how you finish. So let's hope for a really good season 2018-2019.
I would like to the regular season ends on April 6th. I would love to come on this podcast again with you, Dave, and start talking about a hockey game played past April 6th, but still in this season for the Carolina Hurricanes.
Oh, my God, that's going to be great. I can promise you I will definitely buy a playoff tickets if they do, and hopefully, so, for sure.
Sounds Sounds great. Dave, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. All right. A lot of fun with Mike. He's a trip, and a lot of fun talking Hurricanes. They're off to a blistering start. My pro teams are doing very well, so that helps me out a little bit. Redskins doing very well. The Hurricanes are doing very well. And so they're off to – both teams are off to a good start, much better than what I expected. And hopefully the second half of the season for the Pirates can be good. And, Kyle, I know that, by the way, Tom McClellan, I want to give him a shout-out, the SID for East Carolina, Sports Information Director. He actually put out a fun fact, and Kyle, I'm going to put you on the spot. I don't know if you've seen this tonight. It was a tweet Monday night. We're recording this. Do you know the last time ECU started a true freshman? Bubba knows, so Bubba don't say anything.
The last time ECU started a true freshman at quarterback. Well, give me a minute.
Can we get the Jeopardy music going?
Well, Shane was not a true freshman.
Correct.
Let me think back. Man.
It's not in recent years. I'll give you a hint. It's not in recent years. So
I mean, give me the decade.
90s.
The 90s.
Yes, sir. When you were just absolutely too cool when you started jacket.
Marcus Crandall, 1993.
That's correct. It wasn't Marcus Crandall, but you are correct of why that we had to start a true freshman. And Bubba, you're the stats guy.
Crandall got knocked out against UCF. But I thought he was a true freshman that year. I guess he was a redshirt freshman in 93.
He was a redshirt freshman.
Okay, Crandall got knocked out against UCF. And who was the quarterback that came in and replaced him, guys? I do not remember.
Kester, who he got hurt. He was playing against Washington, the Huskies. We lost 35-0 at Washington. And so then we had to start Perez Madison. Perez Madison went on to be – he had a really good day, actually. Threw for a few touchdowns, had a great day. He finished his career as a D-back for the Pirates, right, Bubba?
Right, yeah. Perez Madison made that transition from quarterback to the defensive back, and he actually became a pretty good return man as well, kickoff returns. He had a strong kickoff return or two down in the – Orange Bowl against Miami in that 31-6 win over the Hurricanes.
That was a huge win. I love that. I'll never forget how many people were at the Greenville Airport for the Pirates. It was just that was so awesome that night. Never forget that. That was when I was right out of college covering the Pirates. As a matter of fact, that Miami win, that 96 team, as you guys know, is very special. So we're going to, again, preview the Pirates, but Bubba, you actually had a chance to get this next guest and talk about a legendary coach. What a great get by you on this one and the next guest after that. So tell people who's coming up next.
Yeah, that's what this next guest, he was a football coach at four different FBS schools. Started off at his alma mater, Georgia Tech. And then he moved on to Alabama. And then after a few years at Alabama and the University of Kentucky before wrapping up his head coaching career at Georgia State and the first coach in that program's history. But I'm talking about Bill Curry. He played at Georgia Tech, like I mentioned, his alma mater. He played center for the Yellow Jackets, then went on to play for the Green Bay Packers and played in Super Bowl I with Vince Lombardi. So just a tremendous man. He's done so much for the game of football on so many levels, not only as a player and as a coach, but then he's somebody that really took a leadership role. And then he also was a commentator, of course, for years for ESPN. A lot of times he would be paired with, I think maybe it was like Dave Barnett and Golic.
All right. Well, let's go to the legendary coach. He's got some great stories to share. And let's go to Coach Bill Curry, and let's go to his interview with him. Let's go right now. Another great guest on the Sports Objective. Man, this guy has got one heck of a resume and a long, lengthy one. In fact, played for the legendary Vince Lombardi and obviously lots of great players in the NFL. Great coach, player. I'm talking about the legendary coach, Bill Curry. Coach, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for even paying any attention to all that crazy stuff that we did.
I was looking back. It's funny, Coach, I've followed your career all my life, and you think, oh, I know a lot about this guy, and then you start reading and reading and doing research, and myself and Bubba, and it's just amazing the career that you've had. I wanted to start off with your time. I know that you had a lot of great time as a player. How did it talk about going all the way back? I know you played at Georgia Tech under legendary Bobby Dodd. How did that? How did you choose Georgia Tech?
Well, I think if we're really, really blessed and lucky too, both of those, we get a chance when we get old. I'm 75 now. We get a chance to reflect and look back and count our blessings. And when I count my blessings, and I do every day, and I thank God for the great stuff that happened to me. There were plenty of hard things that happened, as they do for everybody. But I've been surrounded by the greatest leaders, people who know how to lead others, who know how to encourage, who know how to set positive examples. I mean, over and over and over. I even married a great leader. My wife, Carolyn, we've been married 55 years, and she's a great leader in her own right. So starting with grammar school teachers, high school coaches, and then the coaches that you just mentioned, it was as if somehow I was given special privileges to be surrounded by great human beings. And some you learn from each one of those. So if anything distinguishes me, it is the people that I was privileged to be associated with.
I know that you go from Bobby Dodd, and then you play for, I mean, man, we could do several podcasts on just Vince Lombardi for sure. How did it feel to play for such a legend like him?
Well, I didn't answer your question a minute ago. You said, how did I pick Georgia Tech?
Right.
And I never answered you. But okay. one was because of Bobby Dodd. I was a lazy high school student. I'm ashamed of that. And for you, if there are any of you high school kids listening, do not do what I did. I goofed off in high school. I had no business at Georgia Tech, but it was the closest school to Agnes Scott College, which is a girls' school in Decatur, Georgia. And at Agnes Scott was going to be one Carolyn Newton. And I had decided in the sixth grade that I was going to marry her. She was not interested, but I was relentless in my pursuit. So I went to Tech because of Bobby Dodd and because it was closest school to Agnes Scott. My dad was a Georgia Bulldog, so I was supposed to go to Athens, but Athens was too far. So anyhow, Carolyn's been my wife for 55 years. Georgia Tech ended up being the second best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me to learn how to work and to learn how to think and how to attend class. So I went to Tech for some crazy reasons, but it ended up being a great thing. And then playing for Vince Lombardi was the polar opposite of playing for Coach Dodd. Coach Dodd was the epitome of the Southern gentleman. He wore a suit and a brown fedora on the sidelines every Saturday. We worshipped him. He was quiet. He was gentle. Unless you cut class or took a cheap shot in a game, I did both. If you cut class or took a cheap shot during the game, you did not ever want to see him again. It was a nightmare. So he could be brutal if you turned brutal on him. And he warned us about those things. He said, you better go to class. So we learned that was reality. But then I got to Green Bay. Here was this guy that was not Southern. And he talked like this year, and he was from Brooklyn. He said, your religion, your family, the Green Bay Packers, that's all you'll think of, in that order. And we thought he got confused about the order of priorities when we got on the practice field. But he was a force of nature. He was powerful every day and demanding, and I was immature, and I didn't do well under Coach Lombardi, but I learned how to grow up and be a man under him, and I'm eternally indebted to him. Our relationship was complicated, but he was truly great. Both of them were.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know that you were part of Super Bowl I, which is amazing, and you got a chance to snap the ball to Bart Starr, one of the greatest quarterbacks in the NFL history. What was it like playing with him?
It was like stepping in the huddle with Mount Rushmore. I mean, imagine being – they had 20 rounds in the NFL draft in those days, and I was the 20th pick, naturally. I was an undersized center from Georgia Tech, and Vince Lombardi had turned to his personnel man late in the night and said, Pepler, and the guy's name was Pat Pepler. He said, Pepler, we've drafted 19 players. It's 2 in the morning. I'm exhausted. I'm going to bed. Do something humorous with the 20th selection. So they did. And there I was, that 20th selection. And lo and behold, it happened that I had a chance to play. And the next thing I know, I'm sure enough hiking the ball to Bart Starr, which is another one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, because Bart is the finest gentleman, the most wonderful competitor and leader that ever stepped in the huddle. And then a few years later, I had the chance to step in the huddle with another guy who was his equal. And I think these two stand alone, but that's John Unitas. So to have been able to hike the ball to those guys and then be their personal protector is one of the great privileges any competitor ever could be allowed.
And you also played under one of the legendary coaches I was going to ask about, Don Shula. What was he like? Was that like a night and day between Lombardi and Shula?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. All three of the coaches were very demanding. All three of the coaches were totally honest. We knew if they told us something, you could write it down. You didn't have to wonder if they were lying to you. They were also utterly consistent in their policies and the way they did things. And you don't have a great team unless you have those attributes. And a real leader is a person that tells you the truth, even when it's hard, and who loves you enough to make you do the right thing when the moment comes. And that was Shula's greatest gift, in my opinion. He's the winningest coach in the history of the NFL for a reason. My first game with him, he made me special teams captain, which thrilled me to death. Coach Dodd had forced all of us to learn how to cover punts and kickoffs, and we were required to become good in the kicking game. I was a long snapper. So he let me be special teams captain, and guess what? I clip a guy right in front of the bench, an 80-yard punt return, and I clip the guy. And he came running on the field and grabbed my shoulders and screamed some things that would have made Coach Lombardi proud. And being a competitive kind of guy that I am, I screamed some things right back in his face. A stupid thing, terrible thing to do, because I did not think I had clipped. So we're watching the films on Tuesday morning, and the assistant coach, John Sandusky, said, Curry, is that a clip? And I said, it might be. He said, well, let me make a suggestion. The next time you decide to dog cuss the head coach on national television, you'd be very sure that it's not a clip. And I thought, wow, a one-game career with the Baltimore Colts. So I went and found Coach Shula. He took me in the equipment room, and I apologized. Coach, I was out of line. I'm stupid. I'm sorry. And I won't do that again. You know what he said? He smiled. He said, I kind of like that. I kind of like that. Just don't clip the guy. And you think we played hard for him? If he believed in you, he would never give up on you. Never. And he gave me one chance after another until I had the privilege of having a long NFL career. And he's the reason. So I owe my career to Don Shula in more ways than one.
I know that a lot of people will be impressed, and I know I am, with the fact you won 3 NFL championships, 2 Super Bowls, and, of course, an NFL championship before that. And I know that has to make you proud.
Well, that's certainly not an individual thing. For me to stumble on some of the greatest teams of all time was just a luck of timing. And, yes, I've worked hard to have the opportunity, and yes, we had great teammates at each spot, and we learned to stick up for each other. And here again, standing together as a team, no matter what we went through. We went through NFL strikes. We went through controversy. We had a strike. I was president of the Players Association, and all the stuff that's been written about Colin Kaepernick was written about me, all except we did not disgrace the flag ever. But we were called communists and no good, overpaid. Our average salary was, for God's sakes, $30,000. We were overpaid, according to the media. So the players who try to protest, and we did all that stuff with good intentions, trying to improve the pension plan for the NFL players, and eventually some of those things worked out with later generations. But it was just an incredible time to be in the league.
I know that you were, I see that you also did some media work at WAGA from 1970 to 1972 as well. I know that is something that if you're a member of the media, that's it's not an easy gig. How did you like being a sportscaster?
Well, it was a great education. I enjoyed it. I wasn't very good, but I was local. So they said, oh, he's terrible, but he's Bill. He's from College Park. So. And I loved it. I enjoyed being on the air every night and doing the sports. And I can tell you this, the stuff about fake news, there was no fake news. If you did anything that deviated from the truth, you were smashed and probably fired. You just didn't. You had to research your stories. You had to tell the truth, and that was the training. And people like Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and folks like that were greatly respected and still are. That's what that taught me, though, that for the most part, there was no such thing as anybody trying to manipulate the news. So that, I think that was the best thing I learned in that situation. And then I was really, really lucky years later. I had 11 years with ESPN, and I tried to follow the same principles there.
I was going to talk about that, and I want to talk next about what most people may know about you is your coaching and a great coach. Man, what a coach. You started out as an O-line coach. You get a job at your alma mater at Georgia Tech in 1976. I wanted to ask you, is there any pressure coaching at your alma mater?
Well, there was because, first of all, the worst preparation to be a coach is to play in the NFL a long time because you think you're learning football. You hang around with Vince Lombardi and Don Shula and Chuck Knox and Chuck Noll and some other assistant coaches who became head coaches that were just brilliant guys. So people assume that you learn a lot of football, and all I learned was how to survive as an offensive center. It took every fiber of my being. My job was to hike the ball and be run over slowly. And that's all I could do. And I didn't know anything about all the other details, especially in college coaching, recruiting, fundraising, organizing an entire offensive line, and then later an entire team. So I'm grateful that people were patient with me at every stop. But I had an awful lot to learn when I started coaching.
I know you were head coach of Georgia Tech for seven seasons from 1980 to 1986. That's about the time that, as a kid, I started following. So that's where I really remember you. ACC Coach of the Year in 1985. That's something to be very proud of.
Well, we were coming out of being an independent Georgia Tech. That's a long story. We don't have time for today. But we were moving into the ACC. Clemson was about to win the national championship in 81. Our first season at Tech was 80 as head coach. And North Carolina had people like famous Amos Lawrence and Kelvin Bryant and that monster linebacker. I can't believe his name is slipping my mind. LT. So we were playing against people like that, and we had to gear up in a hurry. So for us to get competitive and to have a chance to be one of the better teams in that league, yes, that was a great honor to assemble the guys that accomplished that.
I know you trying to do your career in a short period of time, but respecting your time. I know that you replaced Ray Perkins at Alabama after 1986. What's it like coaching for Alabama?
It's incredibly energizing. You don't ever have to motivate an Alabama football player. They know why they're there. They know that they're expected to win championships, and they will lay it on the line every day, practice and games, to get themselves ready. Now, class attendance was another matter. We had work to do to get people, but that was no different than any of the schools we coached, Georgia Tech, Alabama, Kentucky, Georgia State. We had to work on class attendance to make our guys understand that that was, you don't go to class, you don't play. So, but to walk on that sideline at Alabama and to stand where great, great men, not just Coach Bryant, Coach Bryant was a great coach, but there were plenty of other great coaches there as well. It was a powerful experience, and I would like to have done a better job. I'd like to have done a better job everywhere that we went, but it was difficult for our family, and that was the reason we moved on. It was very demanding on them, and I just felt like it was my duty to change the scenery.
And you go from Alabama to Kentucky, which is normally more of a basketball school, but boy, you had a great time there, I know, at Kentucky.
Well, I sound like a broken record. I wish we had done better. We should have done a better job, but we got a lot of great friends at each place. Moving like that gave us an opportunity. We're going to go see some friends from Kentucky this weekend that have, we maintained our relationship, and we have friends in Tuscaloosa, and of course, living in Atlanta. We're just blessed to have been a lot of places, and we enjoyed all of them.
I know that we've got a few minutes left. I don't want to take a lot of your time, but I know you had time with one of my favorite coaches of all time is Rick Smith, and I wanted to get your comments on Coach Smith.
Well, Rick, when you call his name, a whole lot of feisty encounters between him and me, between him and players, between him and anybody that could help us win or who was trying to keep us from winning. Rick is a great, great competitor and a wonderful human being. He's the kind of guy when the chips are down and you're sitting in a staff meeting and everything's looking bleak, you can look across there and he may not be grinning, but he'll work up a little smile and he'll have an idea about something that can help us to get back on track and to win or to get this guy to graduate or to go to class or whatever it takes Rick Smith's willing to do.
I wanted to ask you about your time where you mentioned earlier in the interview about ESPN. What was it like to be an analyst and sports writer for ESPN.com for those 11 years?
It was the ultimate change in scenery. And here again, back to this era where there's a lot of talk about fake news, you didn't dare try to slip in one lie or one untruth or try to embellish what was going on. You're expected to tell the absolute truth or you were called on the carpet every single time. I'm talking about during the broadcast. Somebody would get in your ear, hey, you need to correct that. And then you had to go back on the air and say, I was wrong about that. That isn't true. Here's the truth. I'm sorry. So I got another education in how it ought to be done, that you tell the truth. And that was revelatory. And then to get a chance to describe football was just really a joy. The study and the preparation was almost like coaching. We had to know every system for the other team and know where guys came from and what their mamas did or their dads for a living. And I was trying to communicate with the housewife and with a sophisticated football mind and trying to walk a tightrope to communicate what was really what it felt like to be on that field. And it was a challenge that I thoroughly enjoyed.
And then you did that for 11 years. And then once you're a coach, you're always a coach. You're the first head coach. First head coach, the same way with broadcasting coach. It's the first head coach at Georgia State from 2008 to 2012. What was that like?
Well, I could not have imagined how to be the football coach at a place where we didn't have a football. we didn't have a chin strap. We didn't have a player or a coach or a field or a locker room. And to start from that point was, once again, a great education. Something that everybody should know is Georgia State is my wife's, one of my wife's alma maters. She went to Agnes Scott for undergraduate, but she earned a master's and a PhD while raising our children at Georgia State. And so we feel deeply indebted to Georgia State because they allowed for flexible scheduling for her. So we went at that job as a labor of love. We love Atlanta. We both grew up here in College Park, right outside Atlanta. My pop worked in downtown Atlanta, so downtown to me was like Disneyland as a kid. But it had gotten, it had become run down, and Georgia State has basically saved downtown Atlanta. Football is a big part of that, and it's becoming a bigger part now, especially with the addition of the stadium. It used to be the Braves Field, is now Georgia State Stadium. It's beautiful, and they're going to do great things. And the school is doing phenomenal things now in various, a lot of their departments are in the nation's leaders. Georgia State is the, it graduates more minority human beings than any other public school in America. And that's, it's just a great university, and we're awfully proud to be affiliated.
The legendary coach, Bill Curry, I tell you what, it's been an honor to have you on, and I hope you'll come back on from time to time with us. Thank you so much for being with us.
I'll be glad to. Thank you, David.
Very surprised, guys, that in that interview that he talked about how he and Coach Lombardi didn't get along. So I don't think he has any love loss. I don't think there's any love loss between, obviously, the deceased Lombardi and Bill Curry. But that was very interesting. Of course, Bart Starr and Super Bowl I. And he had he's had an amazing career and great get, Bubba. That was tremendous. Love that very, very much. The Pirates, again, we're going to do our preview. If you're wondering, this is a special episode. We have several interviews we're going to have tonight. And want to do that. But Pirates are looking for a huge win. And, of course, we talked about Holton Ahlers. I want to get your take. We've had a lot of response, so I want to get that both of your feedback that you're hearing about the interview we had with Scott Weatherby. That was another reason why I want to do this podcast. Guys, what have you heard?
People are very positive about it. After hearing the interview with Scott, quite a few people are now quote unquote jumping on the bandwagon that they want Scott Weatherby to be our next athletic director. We don't want to get Scott. You don't want to get word back to Eastern Michigan, guys. Weatherby has not approached us to try to get the job at all. But you know, we want Scott Weatherby. Full disclosure, you know, who knows if he wants us, but we want him. And the fans that have listened to it. A lot of people have, a lot of people were already on board with it from the time he was here, and even more people after hearing the interview now and hearing the passion he still has for East Carolina and his love for the university and how intelligent and well-spoken he is and how personable he is are getting behind Scott. Sure would be nice to have him as the athletic director. You know, I honestly would rather have him than Dave Hart, and that's not a knock on Dave Hart. It's just Scott's a younger man. He's in his early 40s, I believe.
He's 43 years old, and Dave Hart's 69, maybe point going on 70.
Exactly. So I think Scott will be the right man for the job, and we do a tremendous job here.
I think he would do an excellent job, and he's a friend of ours because he came on the podcast, so we love him a lot, and very happy to hear folks the reaction they're getting, because I think there's a lot of people in Pirate Nation that already knew who Scott Weatherby was. Not everybody, but enough because of his getting 24,000 season tickets. I mean, oh my God, can you imagine going back to those days? I know that was under the really good years under Skip Holtz, and everybody's excited. However.
Right.
You have the great leadership of Terry Holland. You have the marketing and tickets under Weatherby. I mean, Weatherby knows He knows marketing. He knows tickets. He knows fundraising. He did a tremendous job as an interim AD down at Mississippi State, right, Kyle?
Yeah, absolutely. He was at Mississippi State as interim athletic director, so he's got that experience of running a big-time program in the SEC. He's doing a good job at Eastern Michigan. He has the background with tickets and marketing. He knows what he's doing. And as far as if he was making the hires for the next football coach in East Carolina, he knows the kind of person that works here.
Right.
When I mean works here, I mean the kind of head coach that is going to win at East Carolina. He was here when Terry Holland hired Skip Holtz. He was here when Terry Holland hired Russell McNeil. Two totally different coaches, but both guys that fit the culture of East Carolina. And speaking of ticket sales and getting ticket sales up, basketball ticket sales should be going up with Joe Dooley. And, Bubba, you have some information about Media Day?
Yeah, I'd say, like you're referencing first, as far as the ticket sales, I saw something that was put out today is either by ECU Athletics or ECU Basketball on Twitter just talking about how we had surpassed last year's mark, and it didn't give an exact number, but that the season ticket sales are going very well. And, yeah, Coach Dooley and Justice Abasahan, they were up at AAC Media Days yesterday and today in Philadelphia. And if you want to see those complete remarks, check out ECUPirates.com. They have a transcript as well as some video. But essentially, Coach Dooley talked about the difference between ECU now and his previous stint back from 95 to 99. He also talked about the importance of getting players to buy into playing defense and how he was accomplishing that. And then he also talked about, of course, we have point guard Sean Williams, tremendously exciting player. He really made Minji's get rocking a few times last year, despite the fact that we weren't anywhere near where we need to be as far as W's and L's. But Sean Williams shot the lights out, particularly in conference play. And he, of course, won AAC Rookie of the Year. And then he also touched on some other topics as well. So some good stuff with Joe Dooley up in Philadelphia at the conference media days.
And by the way, am I remembering wrong, guys? Both of you guys keep up with basketball more than I do. Do we have a transfer that didn't play last year that's eligible this year, or am I just making that up?
We do. That's one day from Virginia Tech.
Okay.
He's going to be there. And we've got a lot of talent. Speaking of talent, we have a lot of talent on the team. I thought it was funny that on Hoist the Colors, by the way, guys, it was last week or the week before, the weeks are running together for me. But they actually, there's fans that are saying we're not getting this player and we're not getting this player and that player and all this kind of stuff. And they're worried about who we have. Let me just tell you that with Joe Dooley and the rest of the coaching staff that we have, it's a rock star coaching staff. And I'll put those guys could easily be, as we talked about Kyle last time, you said it, in the ACC. And
yeah, the staff's excellent.
The staff, yeah. And so when you have guys that, I mean, I'm hearing now that the Dooley before he even had a job was reaching out to the local coaches, okay? So don't think that Joe Dooley's sleeping on players like we've had in the past in recent years. So that's not going
to
happen.
It's going to take some time to build relationships with local schools that the previous staff didn't do. And, right here where I live in Lenoir County, if we could just somehow get into that Kempston pipeline,
yep.
I mean, there is so much ACC and NBA talent that comes out of Kempston, no bigger than it is. It'd be nice if you want two of those kids to go to East Carolina.
It would, and we're actually going to be, if people don't know, being our first basketball season, we'll be covering basketball and baseball, and we also have other stuff with and we're keeping our eye out for the Olympic sports, too. So we'll be doing that as well. And basketball is just around the corner, right? It's actually the night it starts is election night. So you can go vote and then go see the Pirates. And you can get your tickets, by the way, 1-800-DIAL-ECU. Or if you want to do the order them online, you can just simply go to ecupirates.com. I have four seats, and hopefully you guys will come join me for some games. We'd love to have that. Would be fun to see some basketball together. And that's going to be a lot of fun this season. But I promised Coach Dooley back in June when he came on the podcast, and I kept my word. And I won't be able to go to all the games, but I wanted to show support for how much I think of Coach Dooley, how much I love basketball. And I want to send a message to Pirate Nation. Let's go in there. Let's have, man, there's been so many games. I know you guys have probably been there too, where that basketball arena is like one of the loudest in the country. It's got that potential.
Yeah, when it's packed because of, you know, just the aesthetics of it, how low the roof is,
right?
It can be very, very loud. There's just hadn't been a lot to be loud about in entire basketball history. And hopefully Coach Dooley will change that, and we'll have some success.
Yeah, I would say there's no doubt that Minji's can be a very difficult environment in which to play. And if you need somebody to verify that, you can talk to Tom Crean and Dwayne Wade. They certainly found out twice. And then, of course, Sidney Lowe at NC State, he could tell you as well. But then I also remember other games. I remember us playing in the Bill Herrien days. I remember us hosting Ole Miss. It'd be fun to get somebody like that back on the schedule, beating those guys. I'm trying to remember the name of their coach at the time, but actually maybe it was Rob Evans or something. But anyway, Coach Evans wore glasses, and that's what our students started chanting, "Sit down, Urkel."
Oh, man.
But then we also, of course, we never knocked off Cincinnati, I don't believe, when with Bob Huggins there, but gave them several games, took them down to the wire, of course, beat Rick Pitino. But that,
right, Louisville.
Now, whether that – I mean, obviously that was before he really got things rolling. That's his
first year, but
with our lack of success, that was still a huge win for our program at the time. Dave, as far as – the season is actually, it's 3 weeks from tomorrow night, and it's actually a doubleheader. The women will play University of Maryland Eastern Shore at 5:30, and then the men play Delaware State at approximately 7:45. So it's gonna be a great night.
Can't
wait for that.
Yeah.
When we beat Louisville, now that was before Rick Pitino had got the shoe money going up at the U of L head. And, you know, so they weren't cheating yet. But can either one of you confirm or deny if he was having an affair with waitresses on tables at that point or not?
I don't know. I'm not Rick Pitino's handler, so I don't know. And I just want to remind folks that, you know, things were so bad with the basketball program. People were saying we should have Rick Pitino, and they started naming all these people.
In fact, I heard they were reaching. There were some of our fans who were actually reaching out to Waffle House and IHOP waitresses, just in case. I'd heard that rumor.
But no, guys. Before we move on from the basketball topic, I do remember a funny story, or a funny video rather, about Rick Pitino that year when we beat him in Minji's. That's what I can't remember if it was when he was coming onto the court prior to the game starting, or coming back onto the court at halftime, or after halftime rather. But you know how we had had the cheerleading mats on,
right?
Yeah, that's what Rick Pitino, and somebody had got a video. I don't know if it was Billy Weaver or who it was. They got a video of Rick Pitino tripping over the cheerleading mat. It was pretty funny.
Oh my God! Yeah, well, he definitely didn't like the. I know that. And another thing, if you guys remember, speaking of Louisville, not to bring up a sore subject, but I'm going to. I don't know if you remember, but in the late middle 90s there, we were trying to get into Conference USA.
Oh, yeah.
And they did not want us in. We're like, you know, the Eastern Carolina Rednecks or whatever they wanted to say. But they did not want us in. And they were – I don't think they ever got over the fact that we were in their conference. But anyway – they're in the ACC now. We're in the American. Eventually, let's get back to football, because I had a stat I want to bring to your attention, guys, which you already probably know this, but I want to bring this and get your thoughts on this. Potentially, notice I said potentially, there is going to be four more games on our schedule, left on the schedule, where we're playing a top 25 opponent. We have UCF, and in the next couple of weeks, we'll see how there's a potential that Memphis could be in there. We have Cincinnati, and then if NC State still, you know, if we have to play that game, we'll see if how that plays out. This Saturday, they play at Clemson, so who knows with that game. State may end up winning that game, and I'm out of money or whatever. They'll refund the money, I guess, the December 1st game. Who knows? But we potentially have four top 25 teams left on the schedule. I want to get your thoughts on that, guys.
I don't think Memphis is going to be in the top 25, so let's go ahead and break it down to three.
Okay.
I think that sounds like Montgomery's excuse to try to keep his job at the end of the year. But I think, you know, I had to play three top 25 teams at the end of the year, guys. I think that means we're playing quality competition, and probably means we're going to have three losses there. The schedule's tough. It is what it is. I mean, we've always played tough schedule in East Carolina. You don't
Robert McNeil talk about putting your big boy pants on, right?
Yeah, you don't back down from a challenge. Anyone, anywhere, anytime is what it used to be. Now it's the opposite of that. So Cincinnati. I don't know. I'm still not sold that Cincinnati's legit. Now, are they good? Yeah, they're good. I still don't know that they're
top 25 good.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, they're up to 20th this week. So yeah, that I'm like Kyle. The jury's still out on them. Obviously, they're so much better than they have been in the last, I guess, 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
It, maybe a little bit more because in those last 2 or 3 years of Tommy Tuberville, they were pretty rough to say the least. But yeah, I'm interested to see how things play out in this back half of the schedule.
Best they've been since 2014 for sure. Their head coach is in his second year. Had a tough first year, and year two with Tommy T's players, they're undefeated.
They're not my players. They're not my. Oh, I'm sorry. So that year two. I want to get your take, too, on another thing I forgot to mention on the playback the other day when we were recording on Sunday. I want to get your take on what do you feel about the fans in Nebraska? Do you think they're going to be patient with Scott Frost?
He'll win a couple before the year's over. He's in a tough situation, man. That was his starting quarterback got injured, and then the backup quarterback who thought his
transfers.
He's just going to have some patience. Because that kid would have been the starter, and they would have been probably just fine.
Right.
That'll be nice. When Scott Frost is going to get it done in Nebraska. He's going to get it done there. Look, a guy, there's a difference between being patient. And we've been patient with Montgomery, by the way. This is year three. But there's a difference between being patient with a guy who's gotten it done and proven he can get it done than being patient with a guy is an unproven commodity. Scott Frost is a good coach. It's a shame he's in the situation he's in at Nebraska with the quarterback. Don't have one. And
we know all about that, right?
No, we don't. We've had plenty of quarterbacks. So check Washington State right now. Or unless you're referring to the 2015 season. But
I was talking about 2015 when
I guess any offense is predicated to having a quarterback. But, you really need a running quarterback to run that offense. Scott Frost wants to run an athletic running quarterback. And they'll get it done before the year's over. They almost beat Northwestern this past weekend. And I think they'll be – now – look, next year he still needs to show major progress, but they're not going to fire him after year one. He's one of them.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a question for both of y'all.
Okay.
If Nebraska did fire Scott Frost after year one, would you hire him?
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
That's a no-brainer.
Yes, sir. I don't even have to sleep on that one. I don't even have to think a second on that one. You sign it on the dotted line, sir.
Yes, just like back in the day. Now, obviously, I have to think about and look and see what year it was, and we may not have needed a coach. But if we would have needed a coach when Frank Solich was cut loose there, what's it like, 03, 04? Because they had played for the national title in 2001 against Miami and lost in the Rose
right.
Bowl. And then, two, 3 years after that?
Yeah,
he was cut loose.
He had a 10-win season the year they fired him.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yep. And all Frank's done at Ohio is win ever since.
By the way, speaking of which, I want to get your take on both of you. Maybe some people may think it's premature, but there's been posts on the message board. I just want to give a shout-out to our good friend of the podcast, and that's Stephen Igo from hoistthecolors.net. And if you haven't, you don't know what I'm talking about, Google Hoist the Colors and you'll find out what we're talking about. But it's a great message board. Recruiting, it's just tremendous. And Stephen and his staff do a tremendous job. But anyway, there was a post on there, what happens if Montgomery gets fired? You know, they were asking about who you would go after, your coaching candidates. We were not going to talk about that. I want to ask you guys, realistically, what you think we have as far as money-wise, and what should we pay for a coach if this does happen? I know it's a little bit before, maybe a little premature, but to compete with the teams in the American, what do you think we should give not only the head coach, but the assistant pool or salaries as well?
I think actually what we're paying for a head coach is fine. We're paying, I believe Montgomery makes $1,200,000, I believe. I think between that and I think between $1 million and $1.5 million is appropriate. I think you can get a damn good head coach for that price. From you can get Mike Houston for that price.
Right.
You can get all kinds of coaches. I could give you my whole list. Bill Clark. Go on and on and on. What we need to do is expand, and we did it for basketball. So I'm assuming we find a way to do it for football. Well, we got to find a way to pay our assistants more.
Right.
I don't know. The exact number for that.
It's got to be at least $1 million, right? $1 million, $1.5 million.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what we're paying now for all our assistants. That actually sounds low to me, David.
You're right, because I think the coordinators are getting about $400 apiece, somewhere in that neighborhood, right? $400 to $500 apiece, Bubba.
I
not sure on that
either. I would think probably around $200,000 would be my guess.
I was going to say, I do know that how you think back to prior to that 2015 season, remember Pirate Radio released this shortly after that news came down about Ruffin being fired, just talking about how he had that extension on the table, and because of the assistance compensation or lack thereof, he had chosen not to sign it. So. I'm not sure what the pool of money was at that time.
Yeah, I think the coordinators, David, are making around the $200,000 range. It's just my guess. I think if you could get them up to the $400,000 or $500,000 range, at least the $300,000 to $400,000 range, I think then you could get a better pool of candidates for coordinator. Though I think sometimes you just got to be creative with your hires, man. David Blackwell didn't cost a lot. There's a lot of good coaches out there. If you I'll give Montgomery credit with that one. He found one.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to be smart. You know, if you're really on, like, you know, I've been talking about, if we don't have an AD, that's my fears. We don't have an AD. If Dave Hart does the stuff up and say, I'm going to take the job. Because at this point, I don't see who the hell we're going to hire between now and the end of November. So if Dave Hart doesn't step up and take the job, we don't have an AD. I think our candidate pool is going to be very limited. And you're going to have to look at people that you know you can get that would be successful. Would Mike Houston come not knowing who his boss is going to be? You know, he's a pretty well-paid FCS head coach. It's a good spot to be in. But I do know Elon's head coach is – successful in DJMU this year, And I got Amadi. I can't imagine anyone thinks a head coach any more than $200,000 a year. So I know we could get him even without an AD. You know, I've talked.
I think Mike Houston, even without an AD, I know that's. I'm not taking that lightly. You and I, all three of us, are, and a lot of Pirate fans are very worried about that. So I'm not saying that he definitely would. It's a definite question mark, and you definitely need an AD before the football coach.
You know, if I'm somebody like Mike Houston,
you better give me a lot of damn money before.
Well, incentive.
Right.
I think you could offer him the amount of money we're paying Montgomery, and it'd be a nice pay raise for him. But maybe you tell him, hey, look, maybe Mike Houston says, okay, I'm going to take the job, Dave Hart, advisor to the chancellor. But since you can't tell me who my AD is, if you guys fire me within the first 3 years of my contract, my buyout is XYZ. You know,
right.
my buyout, instead of it being a portion of my contract, I want my buyout with incentives.
Maybe
that's the way to do it.
As far as like what Skip Holtz has, like you were talking about Louisiana Tech with on our playback,
where you get an extension for each year you hit 8 wins.
Yeah,
you know, that's actually a cool thing. I like that a lot.
That's a good
thing. Yeah, you put something like that in there too. You know,
I think you could put a whole bunch of incentives in there, like that about bowl games.
Well, those are normal, but what you got to have, to me, if I don't know who my AD is, I want job security. And to me, job security is, if I don't know who my AD is going to be, if you guys fire me within my first 3 years, you're owing me a whole lot of money. And to me, that's the approach I take if I'm a Mike Houston, if I'm a Butch Davis. These are names that have been rumored. Like I said, somebody like Elon's head coach. Probably could get him for a song and a dance.
He's definitely a dark horse candidate.
Shane Beamer is somebody that I know for a fact is interested in the job.
He wants the job.
And Shane, you know, is with Lincoln and Ruffin right now at Oklahoma. Shane, while he doesn't have head coaching experience, has that pedigree like Skip Holtz did because his dad is Frank Beamer. He knows the area from being in Virginia so long, growing up there. He's recruited this area because he was assistant at Virginia Tech and South Carolina.
From a football school.
Exactly. And since his dad retired, guess where he's been? He's been with Kirby Smart at Georgia and now with Lincoln Riley and Ruffin McNeil at Oklahoma. And he respects our program. He knows the area. He has a lot of contacts. He would put together a hell of a staff, and he would bring back the Lincoln Riley style offense.
And it would make the wonderful Virginia Tech fans, I'm sure that would make them very happy that he.
Oh man, you talk about adding fuel to that fire.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that one. But Shane Beamer is definitely up there. I think the whole issue with, like we were talking about, Bill Clark. I think he's probably as great a coach.
Power five job.
I don't think he would take that with the UAB. I think he's so close. I think he would go to a Power 5 school. It has to be somebody special before. Not that we're not. I'm just saying that something, a really big brand name school before he would leave. That's
well, David, don't we have one more guest to get to?
We do. In fact, we got a huge one here. Bubba, I tell you what, man, this was one of my childhood heroes. And normally I'm not nervous interviewing people, but I felt very nervous interviewing our next guest.
Yeah, damn it, David. Bubba's call got dropped. I was trying to save it.
What it amounts to is we had a great time with the Super Bowl champion, the man who doesn't know how to do the Super Bowl shuffle, or he may not be able to teach me. Jim McMahon, let's go to that call with Jim. Let's go to that interview with Jim, and let's do that right now. Well, I definitely can't dance, but I know a man that can help me learn how to maybe do the Super Bowl shuffle or definitely dance. I'm talking about Jim McMahon with us. Thank you so much for coming on. It means the world to have you on.
No problem. I won't be able to help you with that dancing, though.
Well, I definitely remember being a teenager watching that, and I couldn't do it then. I certainly can't do it now at 45. So, for sure. We want to have you on to celebrate not only your career, but talk about what you have going on right now. And we had a chance to, my alma mater, East Carolina, play BYU last year. So love your school very much. And I wanted to start talking about your career there at BYU. What was it like playing for LaVille Edwards at BYU?
It was it was interesting, isn't it? You know, to say the least, going to school at Brigham Young. You know, I grew up in California. I grew up a Catholic kid, so being at a Mormon school was definitely different. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot of football, and you know, without being there, you know, I was way ahead of the game when I got to the NFL because of my time there.
Sure, I was going to ask you about recruitment. How did the recruitment come, and how did you make the decision to go to BYU, being that you were in California and definitely different than certainly I know the lifestyle of the Mormon faith?
Right. Well, I actually played my last years of high school ball in Utah. My father's job transferred him up there when I was a junior, so I had to finish up in Utah. And then of all the schools that I went to, I went to Nebraska, Oklahoma State, you know, all the big schools back then. But my main focus was to play baseball, and I wanted to go to a school that said I could play both sports, and the only two that said yes was BYU and Nevada, Las Vegas. And that's where I wanted to go, was to Vegas. I came home from that was my last recruiting trip. I had a great time there. They offered me a good deal to go there, and I came home and said, "Pops, I'm going to Vegas." And he said, no, you're not. It's not a big enough school. And then I explained to him, I said, "Well, this is what they just offered me, Pops. You know, house, car, money, easy job at the casino. Hell, who knows where I would have ended up." But he said he wouldn't let me go. He said, "No, it's not big enough, son. You need to go to a bigger school." So that's how I ended up at BYU.
I know that you also, something I learned doing research about you, I didn't know that you actually punted your freshman year at BYU.
Yep. I made the varsity as the punter, and then I was the third team QB my freshman year. And then our starter was injured in week four. So I became the backup, and then I was still punting until my sophomore year.
And boy, you it's amazing. Your last two seasons, 8,100 yards and 77 touchdowns, your final two seasons in Provo. And I know that definitely helped with your chance to get in the NFL, right?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, like I said, being there, I was way ahead of the rest of that class as far as knowledge of, you know, what goes on the defensive side of the ball.
Absolutely. When they retired you, I know they retired your number 9 jersey at BYU. That had to be very special for you.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, I basically did it for my folks and for LaVille. I mean, LaVille really wanted me to get my degree, and he said, "Hurry up and get this done before I die." You know, I saw him 3 or 4 years before he passed. And I said, "All right, coach, I'm going to get it done." And I ended up taking 4 classes 3 years ago and finished up. And they were able to retire my jersey after that.
That is so cool. I didn't know that part, but definitely. I wanted to move to another grade. You had, man, talk about lottery. You had a coaching lottery. You would go from LaVille Edwards to Mike Ditka. What was that like, playing for Coach Ditka?
It was definitely a different different style of coaching, for sure. LaVille was, you know, more quiet and reserved. You know, he let his coaches coach. You know, he always had the final say. But I think that was the genius of LaVille, that he just he hired great coaches and let them do their job. And Ditka was more of in your face every day, you know, wanting to be an offensive coordinator and this and that. And so we had our run-ins, but I have a lot of respect for him. I would have loved to play with him. He was a great football player. And had he ever been in my huddle, I think he'd have understood me a lot better too.
For sure. And you definitely put a magical season. The 85 Bears is one of the legendary teams, one of the best ever. I wanted to ask you about I remember there were so many endorsements you had, and you had and when I think about one of the songs I remember very well because I'm a music nerd, is they used to always play "Born to Be Wild" by Steppenwolf, and there's Jim McMahon. And how did you handle the fame there for that season? Was it tough being able to go out and do things?
Well, know, this city is, Chicago is a great sports town, and they've always treated me great. So it was rough when I was out with my family and kids, because you know, the kids would get trampled over just to get an autograph, and that was tough on them. But I love playing here, and I was here for 7 years. I ended up living here for 28 years. I stayed all the way through until all my kids graduated high school, and then I ended up moving out to Arizona, where I'm at now.
Right. I wanted to ask you about one of the things that I remember now. It's probably not a big deal, but you were fined by the NFL with a headband with the Adidas logo. I know that you were revolutionary, way ahead of your time when it came to endorsements. What was your decision like? You decided to go ahead and just do it? Is that what the decision for the Adidas logo?
Well, the only reason that I was even getting any grief is because Adidas wasn't paying the NFL at that time, which is not my fault. You know, all the other, you know, Nike, you know, all the other shoe companies and helmet companies were actually paying the NFL, and Adidas wasn't. So their rationale was that I was giving them free advertising. And I said, well, I'm not the one with a camera on me everywhere I go. You guys do that. So it's you created this. And then, they ended up finding me in the playoffs for wearing it.
I remember that.
But they didn't find me for the Roselle headband, though.
I was getting ready to say you read my mind. I was getting ready to ask you about that. I remember you came out that. I thought that was very clever of what you did. As far as the Super Bowl, I know that team was tremendous. Do you have any Super Bowl stories, or is there something that you could share with us that maybe folks don't know about that particular game or that season or that nice run you had?
Well, I was getting death threats from Thursday until Sunday of that week. Some reporter went on the news and said that I'd called all the women of New Orleans sluts and the men stupid, and they actually put that on the air.
Oh wow!
And where they got it from, you know, who knows? But that story was false, and you know, they don't care about the falsity of it. You know, they just figured, you know, I was crazy enough to say something like that. And I said, even if I thought it was true, I'd never say that to a reporter. But
right.
So that the rest of the week was very upsetting for me. I mean, it wasn't like this, you know, what I thought the Super Bowl week should be like. And I don't remember much of the game. I was worried about getting shot. So just glad it worked out.
Yeah, it really did. I know you had a nice NFL career. In fact, you were the backup, I know, with Green Bay in Super Bowl 31. That had to be special as well.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was deja vu. I mean, we played in New Orleans on the same day against the same team 11 years later. So that was, you know, quite interesting. But, it, you know, it worked out great. Got a nice ring out of it. And then I decided to call it quits.
And I wanted to ask you, since then, what have you been up to? And certainly I know you said living in Arizona, that's you got to have the nice life now, right?
Well, it definitely feels better on my body. That's for sure. That nice dry heat. I don't do well in humidity, and I'm still dealing with a lot of, you know, head trauma and neck trauma from playing. So I've got to see a doctor in New York every 2 to 3 months, get that straightened out. But at least I know what's wrong with me now. A lot of these other guys are struggling with, they don't know what the hell's wrong with them. And, at least I know when I start having my pains and everything else that it's time to go back to see the doctor.
I wanted to ask you about that, Jim. Didn't you start an initiative against concussions, you and some former players?
Yeah, Jeremy Roenick and I, an ex-hockey guy, we started Players Against Concussions, just trying to, you know, make people aware that this thing is dangerous if left untreated, and trying to get the word out to the younger, you know, the younger generation that they don't need to be playing tackle football until they're at least in high school. That will eliminate, you know, 10 years of head trauma right there. You know, the doctor that I see in New York, he sees hundreds of kids a year that shouldn't be playing any type of sports because their necks are so bad.
Oh, wow.
And, but, you know, it's a lot of the problem is the parents. You know, these parents think that their kids are going to go to the pros from the Pee Wee League, which, you know, it's never going to happen. You know, it's like 1% of people ended up making all the way to the pros. So the parents have got to lighten up and let their kids be kids.
Would you advise, I have a son now that's 5 years old. So wait until he's a teenager before he plays football. Is that the moral of the story then?
That's what I would do. I mean, 2 years of high school ball is plenty for colleges to find you. Because if you got talent, they will find you. Same with the pros. mean, not every roster has, you know, is full of Notre Dame and USC players. You know, there's a lot of, I tell people this all the time. I said, a great example is Carson Wentz. He's doing great right now in the NFL. He went to North Dakota State. So,
exactly.
I mean, they will find you if you got talent, but, you know, you're going to save yourself, you know, 10 years of head trauma. So down the road, it's really going to add up.
I know that that's something I saw in an interview. I think it was HBO, or definitely you've done a lot of great interviews, and I appreciate you coming clean about that and being, I think, the honesty. And I know there's a lot of players that, like you said, that have they haven't had, I guess you've had a better road as far as getting the treatment where they're not, and they, like, use, I guess, drugs or alcohol or suicide, some of the players, so with the CTE. And that's something I was going to ask you about is, what do you think? Is there any way that we can improve the safety of the game?
Well, they've done about as much as they can. I mean, the helmets are great, this and that, but it doesn't matter how good your helmet is. Your brain is still going to smash into your skull every time you have a collision. You know, in the animal world, they have built-in mechanisms to protect their brains, you know, like the rams and the buffaloes that they ram each other in the head all the time. They have built-in protection.
Right.
The human body does not. I mean, our brains are floating in fluid. So when you get hit, it's not going to stop until it, you know, slams into the side of your skull. So,
and I
mean, those things are going to happen. I think just the if they get proper diagnosis and you know, make sure that they don't play again until that is healed. It's basically a brain bruise, you know, and until that heals, you know, you shouldn't be out there.
Well, I definitely appreciate the advice. My son wanted to go to football camp, and we couldn't do it, unfortunately, but I'll make him wait until he's definitely a teenager. Thanks to Jim. I'll tell him Jim McMahon told me to wait. His name is Alexander, so I definitely
want to. Yeah, I mean, he can still play. They got those flag football leagues. They can learn a lot, learn the fundamentals of the game. That's, you know, a lot of that's being lost. But if they learn the fundamentals, and then when it's time to put the uniform on, it'll be a heck of a lot easier and better for them.
Well, I can't wait. I know that you, I know you've got a lot of busy stuff at Chicago, and I appreciate your time. It means the world. I'm a huge fan of Jim McMahon, and it's an honor. It's not every day you talk to one of your heroes, so I appreciate you taking the time with us, and definitely thank you for all that you're doing now about CTE and certainly concussions, because it helps, I think, future generations when they want to play the game of football.
Well, that's the idea. You know, our job's not to make the game go away. It's just to make it better for people, you know, when they're done.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it very much, and I hope we can talk again soon.
All right, great. Have a good day, my man.
Great job from Jim McMahon. He's a lot of fun, and I tell you what, a great time, and we're running out of time. I want to thank Kyle from LaGrange Barber and Bubba Rosenbaum. Appreciate both of them very much. You've been listening to the Sports Objective Podcast.
You've been listening to the Sports Objective Podcast. Join us next time as the guys will be objective, and the objective is sports.